ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. As a result of the coronavirus, there are record numbers of people who've been furloughed or lost their jobs. It's led to a fair amount of reflection, which is why I thought now was the perfect time to interview Paul Mercurio. Paul is an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning actor, writer, comedian, cultural commentator, and satirist. But he started out as a lawyer in a white shoe law firm, and his career journey is both special and inspiring. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm psyched to be on. How are you doing?
I'm good. In the U.S., what one does for a living is inexorably linked to our sense of identity. And when we meet people, it's one of the first things people talk about, you know, what they do. So when people find themselves suddenly unemployed through a force majeure event like a global pandemic, it can be unsettling. And it can also be an opportunity, which is really why I'm so excited to talk to you. And when I first met you, I had only ever known you in your current incarnation, but you've had quite a journey to get here. And it's that journey that I'd like to focus on during our conversation. And first, let's go in the Wayback Machine to college. And what did you study in college? And what did you think at that time, like, I'm going to be when I grow up?
Accounting and economics. I grew up in Rhode Island, didn't leave my house till I was 22 and went to law school because I had to work in the family furniture business, which we all had to do. So, you know, I had never known anything other than the traditional world. My parents are high school educated, small furniture business. The idea of law or investment banking or entertainment was beyond my world, but I majored in business. I like business. I grew up in a business. So accounting and economics. And as I was going through my undergraduate, I started to think, well, maybe I like the idea of law. I read stuff about it. I like to debate, blah, blah, blah. So I decided, you know, I'd go to law school from there. But I was living at home up to that point and working in the business. So basically going to college was really like going to work. Like I'd go to a class, then I have to go to work, go back. So I didn't really have a college experience. But that was sort of the rough plan back then was to take a traditional job, you know?
Wow. And so then you went to law school, but just not any law school. Mm. You went to Georgetown and you don't just fall into going to Georgetown. That takes a real drive. So, you know, you said, well, maybe law, but was it some sort of Atticus Finch, change the world passion or Bonfire of the Vanities, Master of the Universe stuff? Or was it really, I want to get out of my house and out of this furniture place?
it was the last one, getting out of the house. This is how bad it is, Gabrielle. I don't even have furniture in my house because it reminds me of working in a furniture store. We sleep standing up. We have straps in the wall and we just, there's no furniture. We sit on the floor like, all right, anyway. So, no, I think for me, it was actually a little bit more shallow. It was, you know, a middle-class Italian kid working all the time, parents working all the time. I thought it's a profession. It's white collar. I loved carpentry work and I wanted to be a carpenter. My father, who put floors in for a living, and that's real bulwark. Like his knees were all swollen by the end of his life and just a mess. He goes, you're not going to work with your body, work with your head. You know, you'll have a better life, better quality of life. And I thought, okay. Lawyer, doctor, growing up middle-class Italian kid. Those are the things you hear that your parents and aspire to and others. You do that and you're comfortable. You've made it. And so it was, but you know, but so I also liked the idea of doing it. It wasn't just a money grab. It was, I didn't expect to be making millions. I thought, okay, I'll make a nice, comfortable living and I'll do something honorable, be a lawyer. That's funny. So that was really the thinking.
So you're a lawyer at one of the top law firms in the city, which, again, is no small thing. And then you moved to a top financial institution, just snap like that. What drove that shift?
Well, because two things. I was doing corporate law, mergers and acquisition deals. And when you do merger and acquisition deals, and these are very large companies, international companies, the genesis of the deal is the business side, the economics. the financials. So it starts with the investment bankers and the investors. Once there's a deal in place, in principle, in terms of the numbers and the price and this, it gets handed to the lawyers who then negotiate, do due diligence, and bring it home. And I really loved law. I was actually enjoying it, but I was always working across the table or with, on my side of the table, investment bankers. And I kind of wanted to be closer to the genesis of things. And when I look at that now, looking back, it makes sense because I like creating things out of nothing. And I felt like investment banking would put me closer to the genesis of the deal. Plus, they got paid way better than lawyers did at that time because they were getting they would get bonuses tied to the amount of deals they brought in. They didn't have bonus structures at the law firm and when I started. They do now because of exactly what happened to me. The law firms were losing people to investment banks because of bonuses. And they said, man, if we're going to keep these people, we got to pay them better. So not that I was not getting paid well, I was, but, and so that was, and it's interesting, the first like 3 years, you don't really know anything about law because you go to law school, but then you have to learn the practice of law by doing it. And so I was working 24/7 doing these M&A deals, hostage tender offers, all sorts of stuff. And a lot of the associates would complain about the hours. And I looked at it like, you know, I'm getting paid really good money to continue an education. I'm not going to complain. And I had grown up working hard anyway, so it wasn't a big deal. So I made the shift over to the investment banking side to be closer to the genesis of the deal. And also, you know, the money part of it. And I felt like, I also felt like I had kind of seen and done it all with the law. Like I tend to get bored quickly and it felt like I was a little bit on a treadmill just a few years in. And I already felt like, okay, you do this deal, you negotiate this deal, done, you do the next one. And it started to feel a little rote. So I wanted to mix it up for myself too.
Right. So now you're at the investment banking firm.
Right.
When did you start doing comedy work? Or had you been doing, had this been even in college, you were doing stand up at the, you know,
no,
in the
never.
Student place?
No, never. I never did. I loved watching stand up as a kid. I would beg my parents when I was little to stay up and watch any comedian, Rodney Dangerfield, whatever. And then I'd go to school the next day and I'd do like their jokes and impressions and people would laugh at me and think I was funny, whatever. But never, because this is what I meant about like your environment and how you grow up. That my neighborhood and the family I grew up in, the idea of like going into entertainment was so far from the general blue collar nature of my family. It was like saying like, let's take a trip to Mars. Like, so it was never to enter my mind that I could do that as a profession. But I don't know, something was in me and I started writing jokes. I actually started writing short film ideas. Because I think I was watching it so much on TV, the comedy. I'm like, oh, I got a funny idea. Let me write this down. I got a funny idea. And then I made a short film, started making. When I got out of law school and started practicing law, one of the first things I bought that was kind of expensive was a film camera. And I started making short movies. I don't know why. Uh-huh. And then I wanted to do, I was using video. And so like an idiot, my office was in Midtown Manhattan, like 50th and Madison. And I got a location at 52nd and Madison, literally two blocks from where I work in the middle of the day, lied to my boss and said I had to go home because my mother was sick and I was shooting a film. And then I had to shoot on the corner on the street. And you know, when you shoot outside, you have to have a permit. I didn't have a permit. And I'm like, I'm freaking out going, what am I doing? It's lunchtime. I'm totally going to get caught here. Someone's going to see me. But I made the film and submitted it to festivals and it got into some festivals, including the HBO Comedy Festival. And I flew, and again, I lied and said I had something to do. And I flew to Aspen and I sat in a movie theater and on the screen that I normally watched other people's stuff, my thing was on there, my name was on there. And it like blew my head off my shoulders. And then in that same trip, the young short filmmakers, I was in the short filmmaker category. We got invited to a luncheon at Peter Goober's house, who I know you know who that is. He's a major Hollywood producer. I don't know who the guy was, but they take us in a van into the woods. Then there's a horse-drawn sleigh that takes us, I swear to God. Well, in the van, it felt like something bad was going to happen in the woods.
There were no bags over your head.
No, yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't know. I have no state secrets, please. And then in a clearing is this massive house, the hills of, you know, around the, my Aspen Mountains around it. And I walk into the lobby and I look down into the entryway of the house and I look down and there's a brook inside the house, not a man-made brook. The guy, I'm like, this guy's got so much money. He just built his house like over a waterway, right? And I'm looking around and there's a picture of him and Barbra Streisand, this guy. And I see this same guy. I'm like, okay, this is the guy's house. Him with Paul Newman, him with Robert Redford. I'm like, what the F, right? We go in and at the luncheon is me and a few other short filmmakers, the Hudlin brothers, Spike Lee and Albert Brooks. That's who I'm having lunch with.
Oh my God.
And I'm supposed to be going through financial quarterlies back in New York for an M&A deal. And I'm sitting here talking to these guys. And so I really start to get hooked. And then I go back and then I start writing jokes. And I don't know why I was writing the jokes. I don't know what I was going to do with the jokes. And to the point where I had a secret password kept protected file, because everything you did at the firm, you did in a general information processing system so everybody could get access to the documents. But I put a password on mine and I had like 30 pages of jokes. And,
oh gosh.
And years later, there was a firm alumni function about a year ago, and this old gentleman comes up. He goes, "You remember me?" I'm like, "No." He goes, "I'm Alan Dindis." I'm like, "Oh yeah." He ran the information processing department. He goes,
"Oh God."
He goes, "I want to thank you." I go, "What?" He goes, "You made me laugh plenty of night. I would break into your
Oh my God,
and
no.
Yeah, and I would read your jokes, and they were really entertaining, and they really so now I'm writing these jokes, and then
And this is while you're still at the law firm now?
I'm still at the law firm, but I'm about to be leaving. And then one night, I'm pulling another all-nighter, and our firm is invited to a big client function at new headquarters, downtown Manhattan, and Jay Leno's the private entertainment. And I wasn't going to go because I had so much work. But when I heard it was Jay Leno, I'm like, ah, you know what? I'll just go for like an hour or two and then just come back and work all night. And I stood up, and I'll never forget, I'm standing over my keyboard. I put my overcoat on. I'm like, what the hell? And I hit the print button, and I printed out all these jokes. And I go down, and Jay Leno does like a show for 150, 200 people. And I go up to him with a wad of papers, and I go, look, I don't.
No.
Yeah, I go, I don't know if you need jokes, but, you know, I watch you all the time, and I'm a lawyer. I'm not going to ever use these. You can have them. He's like, okay. It's like, yeah, I was like, you get to laugh because you're not with him. I had to hold it in and I had almost exploded.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
So then he goes, hey, come back here. And I go, what? He goes, you might want to put your name and your phone number on here so I know how to reach you. Like I was so nervous, right? Like,
Oh my God.
And then 2 days later, the phone rings and I hear it's Jay Leno. Is Paul there? And I thought it was my friend David pulling a prank because I told him that I met Jay Leno and he was busting my chops. I go, yeah, really funny. He goes, not really, it's Jay Leno. I go, yeah, right. He goes, no, it really is. And I actually said to Jay Leno, you do a lousy Jay Leno. And yeah. And he goes, I read your stuff. It's clean. Some of it's good. He goes, I'll hire you to start sending jokes into the Tonight Show monologue. And I'll pay you,
oh my God.
I'll pay you $50 a joke. If I use it.
Oh my God.
And I go, okay. And then before we hang up, he goes, by the way, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, you're too wordy. You write like a lawyer. Just get to the punchline already. You're giving me paragraphs of setup. You're not writing a contract. So, and then a week later, he called me and said, I'm going to do one of your jokes on the Tonight Show. And I got a bottle of champagne. Not my wife, Carol, who you know, we had dinner, but my girlfriend at the time, we're living together on the Upper West Side. Went to another friend's house and had a bottle of champagne and he did this joke and it like blew my head off my shoulders more so than the,
screening.
Yeah. Or at least as much. And I think what happened was I had been watching this box, the TV, my whole life since a little kid. And all that time, other people's funny ideas and words came out of it. And all of a sudden, my words came out of that box. And it had an unbelievable effect on me. Now, you have to understand, I repeat this because it's context and your history is relevant. It's like, I'm a middle class kid doing some of the biggest M&A deals in the world from Providence, Rhode Island. And this stupid $50 joke had more effect on me than what I was doing.
Right.
And so I, but I didn't, like, even at that point, it wasn't like, oh, okay, I'm going to make a career of this. It was just this, I guess it's almost like this thing that was inside of me and slowly creeping out. And I couldn't really suppress it even if I wanted to. And I thought I could control it and just shut it off, and I couldn't. So I'm sending the jokes. And so then the stand-up happens because Leno says to me one day, he goes, you know, you could test the jokes out before you send them to me by going to like little open mic nights, bar rooms around the city. He goes, that's where I started. And you could try the jokes out. And I'm like, oh, all right. So I went to one of the big clubs and I asked some people where the, like, you know, open mic amateur nights are. And I started to live a secret double life where I was a lawyer. Now, at this point, I moved over to investment banking, but still essentially the same work, M&A deals. And at night, on certain nights, I would sneak out of work. Everybody else would go to dinner and I would get in a town car and go somewhere in Manhattan to the diviest bar in my Brooks Brothers suit, in a place where, like, one of the places was called Downtown Beirut 2. Like, that was the name of the place. 2. Like, they were franchising these hellholes or something. I don't know. and there were literally pimps and pushers that worked out of there. There was a sign on the men's room door that said the toilet seats only to be used to go to the bathroom, not to cut coke. Thank you, the management. It literally said, thank you, the management, on the sign. And quick story, I go there one night. And I'm waiting to go on stage and I'm in my Brooks Brothers suit and everybody else is just like, you know, leather and jeans and spikes in their faces, like, right. And then me. And I would have the town car park 2 blocks away, like on a dark street. And I'd walk in so that people didn't see me pull up in a town car. Cause like they would have rolled me. They would have, you know, they would've. And so I'm waiting to go on stage and there's a folk singer on stage playing Blown in the Wind, like, yeah, badly, like, right. And then there's a fight at the pool table and one guy runs out of the bar and another guy grabs the side of his neck and he starts screaming, he cut me, he cut me. And he's drunk and he knew the guy and they got in a fight over some drugs and the guy kind of sliced him on the side of the neck and he's bleeding and his girlfriend's freaking out. Oh my God, he cut me, man. And the answer, my friend, the guy just keeps playing like he's not getting off, right? It's total mayhem in the bar. And this guy just keeps playing. So I get up and I start to walk out and I hear the MC go, all right, you guys ready for some comedy?
Nice.
I swear to God. And at this point, the cops are there taking a report. The guy's drunk, walking around with bloody napkins on his neck. His girlfriend's still crying. And I go on stage and I had the presence of mind. I wasn't good at all, but I knew that I had to acknowledge this really bizarre thing that was happening in front of everybody. And I said, it's nice to be here at Downtown Beirut too. I always wanted to follow a slashing. Thank you. I thought that was pretty funny. Well, I didn't get any laughs. And the guy who got cut heard me just say slashing. And I think he thought I was making fun of him because he goes, hey, you making fun of me? I'm not going to take any crap from you, too. And he took all his bloody napkins and he threw them at me.
Oh, no.
And they hit me in my shirt, my white Brooks Brothers shirt. And I have a blood stain on my shirt. Now, the Italian in me, stubborn, I'm like, all right, screw this guy. I'm going to finish my set. I don't care if he drops dead in front of me. Just screw it. And I'm going and no one's paying attention to me. Chatter, cops, walkie-talkies. And then the drunk guy turns back to me. He goes, hey, what are you doing anyway? I go, I'm trying to tell jokes. He goes, oh, yeah? He goes, I like jokes. He turns back to everybody in the audience. He goes, hey, everybody, shut the hell up. This guy's trying to tell jokes. And the whole place shuts up. And I finish. I had like 2 good minutes of material finished.
Oh, my God.
And the end of the story is I go back to the firm. I was supposed to be gone an hour, but I picked a high number. It's a lottery when you perform. And I was gone 3.5 hours and they couldn't find me. And I walk into a conference room, you know, like when your father's so mad at you, like he's seeing, you know, purple and he can't even talk. Like he's just screaming at you. The senior partner of the firm was there and he's usually not there past 6 o'clock. And there's all these lawyers and bankers in the room. And he goes, I acted like a 12-year-old and thought, okay, I'm going to take this file folder and I'm just put it against this blood stain on my shirt and no one will notice. Right. Cause I couldn't go home and change. And I, I walk into the thing and the guy goes, where have you been? What have you been? Why do you have a blood stain on your shirt? Like in seconds, right? So now I'm dead because I couldn't tell anybody at the firm I was doing this because the kind of places I was going to, they would have said, like you said at the beginning, white shoe firm, not acceptable. Our lawyers don't do that. I couldn't tell anybody in the comedy world because they were such lowlifes. I didn't feel safe, right? And they were totally taking my money. So I'm thinking, okay, my thing is up. Story's gonna. What do I say? And then another lawyer bailed me out. He goes, "What kind of shirt is that?" I go, "It's a Brooks Brothers shirt." Why? He goes, "Oh, I thought I had blood out of a Brooks Brothers shirt."
Wow, he saved you. Yeah,
exactly. And then another lawyer goes, "No, Armani's a good shirt where you get blood." And I'm looking at both of them going like, are you guys remaking American Psycho in your spare time? Why do you have so much blood on your shirts, for God's sake, right? Oh my God. And I slink out of the room, and that became my life for a while, where I would, you know, I had other moments where I almost got caught, and I was slowly getting pulled to do the comedy thing, but simultaneously having a nervous breakdown for two reasons. I was already working like 100 hours a week, so now I had this other thing. Plus, I was trying to keep the secret from everybody, including my girlfriend, who I was living with, now my wife, because I felt embarrassed that it was silly and frivolous what I was doing.
So when did you come clean? When did you decide? What was the turning point that made you say, you know what, I'm going to give this a go?
It wasn't one specific thing that happened. It was a buildup, and it was that point at which, like, I had to make a decision to go stick with one thing or the other, because it was literally killing me. I was stressed out. I was tired. And I just didn't want to look back and say I should have. I really, that was the thing. I felt like I could always go back to some form of law, could go back to Rhode Island. My wife and I went to high school together, so we have roots in Rhode Island. So, I felt like I could always go somewhere.
Right.
And one of my friends said, like, you know, what you're doing now is great. And yeah, you're a lawyer, banker at the highest level, but there's still a lot of those firms and those kind of lawyers and bankers. But being a successful entertainer and performer, it's like getting in the NFL or the NBA. There aren't a lot of those, right, relative to how many lawyers and bankers there are in the world. And I remember that stuck with me. And I just went home and I told Carol, I said, I think I want to leave Wall Street to be a comedian. And she looked at me and went, that better be your first joke. and then I fessed up and she goes, oh, thank God. I go, why? She goes, well, I thought you were cheating on me. I go, why? He goes, well, you were coming home like reeking of beer and cigarette smoke. One of your shirts had blood on it. She goes, I didn't know. She found women's phone numbers written on little napkins, cocktail napkins. And she thought I was picking up women at a bar. It was just other comedians that had open mic nights that I could work. So she put a different puzzle together.
Oh my God.
So wow. We had a nice two bedroom co-op on the Upper West Side, beautiful apartment, first thing we ever owned. And I sold that, unraveled my life, moved to a rooming house in New Rochelle, where it was this old rundown house with, we shared a kitchen and a bathroom. And I lived in a 10x12 room with a hot pot on the floor. And there were, I lived with two ex-cons in the house, two recovering addicts. And right above me was a 300-pound phone sex operator who sold Herbalife diet products door to door on the side. Those are my God. And I started, and I kept my car, a Saab, sold everything, sold my stereo, sold my TV. My wife and my girlfriend took a job in Boston, and she's a museum person in the museums up there, which I encouraged her to do because then I could split my time between New York and Boston to do comedy.
Right.
And I started to live the life of a comic, and I would, which means downtown Beirut twos, that kind of place, VFW halls, $50 here, go 2 hours for $50, $25, 2 o'clock in the morning, nobody's listening, getting heckled, had a beer bottle thrown at me. I got stiffed on money one weekend, $250, five shows, the guy stiffed me on my money. And these were people who now had control of my life.
Well, it's interesting because it makes me think of this sort of aphorism that people will say, you know, do what you love and you'll never work another day in your life. And I've always thought that was kind of BS.
And I think you're totally right. That's BS because Life doesn't work that way. The universe doesn't cooperate with you. You don't wake up every day and not have obstacles and bad things happen, even at the thing you love to do. So right. People need to stop. And they also need to, the reason I like talking about this is because I want to kill, there's a misnomer like, oh, you pursue your dream and you got it. No, it was, I'll tell you right now how gut-wrenching it was. It wasn't clean. It wasn't easy. It was emotionally very upsetting, because what happens is you've got to really want it. Like, otherwise, everybody would do it. Everybody would be doing it if it were easy, right?
Right, right.
Like, okay, let's talk about the NBA. Like, you want to be an NBA player. Let's not even say a great one. You've got to really be good. And like, when everybody else is going to party, you got to go to the weight room and you got to do this and make sacrifices and play in little lousy towns and work your way up. Otherwise, if it were like a snap of the finger, everybody would be in the NBA. There's a reason that the process, whatever the thing is that you're doing, is so demanding, because it should weed out those people that don't really want it or don't have the talent or don't have the constitution to fight through to get to the other side.
Well, right. I was going to say, was it all Disney bluebirds and rainbows
no.
once you decided to go?
No,
and it sounds
no,
like
no. What happened was I got really depressed. Like 3 or 4 months in, I started to freak out. And this is really important that people know this, because I just was like, what have I done? I just threw away a law degree. I come from no money. I threw away a Wall Street career. What am I doing? I got to go back. I started freaking out.
So how did you navigate that? Because that's, I mean,
I didn't.
You've stepped off the gerbil wheel, yeah. if you will, or jumped onto a different one.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, all of your friends who are still at the firm, they're still pulling down the money.
Oh,
and
if you, so funny you mentioned that. Yeah. Because what happened is I started running a race with my other career and I was never going to win it. I'm like,
right.
In a year, I got to be making as much money I was making on Wall Street. Well, that's crazy. Like, I would have had to be a star to make in celebrity time, in a celebrity type way in entertainment. And what happened was, you're right. So I was still close to my friends that I worked with on Wall Street, and they were getting promotions and junior partner and managing director. And now they're making 7 figures. And then there was this moment. And my friend Dan got a new house, bought a new big house in Greenwich, invited us out on a Sunday to hang out. I walk in the house, like a party. And I remember I stepped out of the car and I looked and I'm like, my heart sank. I got a pit in my stomach and I'm like, oh, what have I done? And I went into the house and I couldn't talk to anybody. And I went into the bathroom. I locked the door. I put the toilet seat down. I sat down. I put my head in my hands and I went, what have I done? What have I done? I could have had this. I'm never going to have this. What have I done? Why am I putting myself? I got to go back. If I go back now, I could probably have this. What am I going to do? And Carol, my wife, comes knocking on the door. She goes, are you okay? I was in there for 25 minutes.
Oh man.
And then I'm like, yeah, I basically lied. I said, I got an upset stomach. I got to go. And I left and I couldn't face it. And then I got audited by the IRS.
Oh, gosh.
Because I had all this money. And then all of a sudden,
then you didn't.
Right.
So what happened?
And the auditor became the personification of all of my doubts, because this conversation happened. He goes, he's thumbing through my stuff. And he goes, my returns. He goes, oh, you know, you had a lot of income. And then all of a sudden, it just dropped off. You had like a loss. What happened? I go, well, I was a lawyer, investment banker on Wall Street. And I quit to be a comedian. And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, right. What'd you do with the money? I'm like,
oh my gosh, yeah. No. Did he really?
Yeah. He goes, no. He goes, no way. Because then he said, nobody in their right mind would do that. And those are exactly the words that were going on in my head. Why would you do that? And I understood, like, okay, he was an accounting major too, probably. And he got an IRS job and it's comfortable. And I'm not judging it, but he's a guy that's probably risk averse, right? So he can't understand it. And so he became that voice, literally the personification of everything that I was going through. And I'm like, this is it. You got me. I'm done. I'm beaten down. I can't do it. I have the audit. I'm not making any money. These shows are horrible. I'm living in this hole with these horrible people. There's fights outside my doors, an alcoholic that lives. And I'm really freaking out. And I start to talk to my friends on Wall Street. And one of them says, you know, we're opening another department. And, you know, I always love to work with you. Why don't you come in and interview? I'm like, nah.
Oh, wow. That's a hard thing, getting that kind of offer.
So I went out and I bought a suit and I got my briefcase out. And all of a sudden I'm standing on a, the New Rochelle, at the New Rochelle station, Metro North, 7:30 in the morning, with a Wall Street Journal under my arm. And I look to my left and I look to my right, and there's 50 other guys that look just like me, dressed the same way. And I'm heading in to do an interview for a job. I don't even really know what I want. And this has been, this moment that I'm talking about in my life has been up to date the scariest time in my life, because I had no direction. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I had always known what I was going to do. I was very focused, like you said, good college, law school, blah, 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 Wall Street, you know, do well on there. Focused. I know what I want. And it was a hard decision to start with, because societally, we're all trained like, okay, you go, you get a good, nice white collar job of some kind. You work 30 years and you go to Florida and retire. Well, not now, because you'll die of coronavirus if you go to Florida. That's how I got it. But and so now I already broke that mold, which was hard for me to do coming out of the background. Like, okay, I'm going to go do this crazy entertainment thing, and it's very entrepreneurial, and there's no safety net. And now I'm lost, and I got this ability as a lawyer, this ability as a banker, and at that point I was a solid stand up and good joke writer. And I felt like I had these two howitzers loaded and ready to shoot, and I didn't know where to shoot them. And I was I was really, really, really a combination of scared and depressed. I don't know if they're clinically depressed, but very down, lost. And I was looking for a sign from God. Like, what do I do? What do I do? If you look reasonable on the subway, I'd come up to you and say, okay, here's my dilemma. Should I stay? Should I go? And I decide to go, just take the interview, and I do. I go back from follow-up interviews, and I get this offer to go to an investment bank. And one of the most important people in my life is a guy named John McGrath, who was a career counselor at my law, at my undergrad. And I went to him and I said, I don't know. I'm lost. I could go back to Wall Street, I think, but I don't know. I really don't want to do that. I hate this. I don't know what to do. What am I going to do? And he said to me, look, he was very good, because he never told me what to do, but he was sort of gently nudging me in a direction. And he goes, you, where you are right now is you got in the ocean and you started swimming and you left the shore, and you're at the point in the horizon where you can't see the shore you left and you can't see the shore that you're going to, but know that if you keep swimming to that other shore, that it is there. And that really stuck with me, but not enough. So I took the job.
No. Huh. Okay. So continue. Took the job. Yeah. And
what happened was, so I swear off comedy. I recreate my life. I get another 2-bedroom apartment, another TV, buy new suits, swear off comedy, living in Manhattan. And 6 months into that stint on Wall Street, I start doing comedy again, like an alcoholic going for a drink. And that's when I really knew, like, it picked me and I didn't pick it, which is cliche, but it really is true. Like, it just kept coming out of me and I couldn't stop it. And, I also didn't like the guy I was working for, but I needed the approval of Wall Street to go back. It was weird. What happened was, I was doing a big merger deal in Arizona. We were selling an HMO, and I was in Phoenix, and we were at the, now at this point I had gone back to starting to do stand up again on the side. And I had gotten a TV spot before I went back the second time. I landed a TV show where I did, you know, like they have those, like, seven, each comic does, there's 4 comics in a half hour and each does 6 minutes, you know, that kind of thing. And I shot it, forgot about it. And now I'm in Arizona and there's a conference room and this president of the company goes, did I see you on TV last night?
I'm like, oh my gosh.
I'm like, no. He goes, yeah, no, I think I saw you. Like, no. Oh. He goes, yeah, yeah. And they had aired it and I forgot about it and they didn't tell me the air date.
Oh, because
we were
gosh.
Telling jokes. It was something comedy show. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, oh, here we go. In front of my boss. He goes, it was great. He goes, hey, everybody. We have an investment banker who's a comedian. He goes to his secretary. He goes to his assistant. Isn't there a club in town? Let's go down. Maybe we get Paul to do some time. We'll all go out and see him tonight and have some drinks. I'm like, no, 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 I'm good. And I became his favorite banker on the deal because he said the comedy thing humanized me and made me more than just a traditional sort of, you know, money-focused banker, Wall Street person. And humanized me and kind of tied into what that career counselor was saying about, like, you know, there's something bigger that you're doing here, even though you may not be getting paid the same money. And when I got that, and then I told some other people on Wall Street that I was really going to leave again, they go, good for you. One guy goes, I was a good writer and I started to write a book. And then I thought, okay, my parents really wanted me to take a traditional job. And I did. And I got comfortable and the money got better and better. And then we bought the house. Then we bought a boat. And I got, now I'm locked in. He goes, I can't. He goes, don't look back and say you should have. So I left a second time, moved out of that apartment, which we were renting because I couldn't afford to stay there, moved to a smaller apartment, and then really started pursuing it full time. Still with doubts, still hard to sort of see some of my friends doing really well and knowing how comfortable they are or were. But I kind of had to be realistic about the fact that this was just going to come out of me one way or the other.
Right.
And so that kind of then put me on the path to kind of do it full time and get on the Daily Show and stuff like that. But like, it was rough, you know, it was like really all these doubts. I was scared. I didn't like not being sure of myself in terms of what I should be doing. So that's why I say you got to really want it, because it's not clean. These changes, these life, they're not clean. They're just not. They're not work doing something you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. That's just not true. And if anybody right. says that they're doing that, I'm not saying that they're lying intentionally. They're just not being true to themselves. It's just hard, you know?
Right.
And especially right. in a society
that values. And I think what you said about if it was easy, everybody would do it. I think that's actually really the heart of it, isn't it? It's really hard.
Well, it's a small business. You know, it really is. It's a business. It's an entrepreneur. It's no different than I invent the next great semiconductor and then go get investment funding to fund my entrepreneurial endeavor. I'm the product. I create it. I have to figure out how to market it, i.e. get on TV and radio. I have to generate income from it, i.e. start drawing people in comedy clubs to pay to come see me. I have to get myself in front of the camera as an actor. Like, you have to wear all of these hats, and then social media gets added on top of that, which is a full-time job. So now having my business acumen has been good for me and definitely helped me, but
right.
the system is designed to weed out the people that either don't want it badly enough, at least in the comedy world and also on the Wall Street world or entertainment world, I'll put it broader, to weed out people that, you know, you got to be disciplined. You got to write. You've got to, like, people. I think that was the other thing. Like, my friends in the beginning thought, well, like, yeah, you just lay around, you smoke some weed, watch TV all day, you write a couple of jokes, you go out, you tell them, you get drunk, and you go home. It's like, no, it's the opposite. It's just constant work. Find your voice, create your voice. What do I want to say? This joke's not good. I got to get rid of this joke. I got to be more brave on stage. What am I going to talk about? Like, all those soul searching right. conversations that you have to have. And so, you know, anybody listening to this, it's thinking about making a shift. I'd say make it, but know that there are going to be bumps in the road and you got to be willing to withstand it. And you know what? You could be, they could hit those bumps and not be, and just go, it's too much for me. I don't like this uncomfortableness. I don't like the lack of security. I want to go back, and that's fine. But the nice thing is, you lie on your deathbed and you won't go, I should have. You did.
Right.
You tried it. And that to me was important for me personally, you know?
Right. Well, I think the fact that you went back and then back again, that you, the second go round, were honest with the people you were working with about who you were and what you were doing, and that in some ways liberated you. I think that that's really interesting. So we've reached the end of our interview time, but in closing, looking ahead, what's up next for you? What's got you particularly excited? Anything?
Well, you know, we're in this pandemic, and I actually have COVID right now, so I'm kind of quarantined, which is not good for my family. Even my dog wants me out of the house. This is not a good thing at this point.
At least you're home, though. You're not, you know, yeah, risking hospitalization,
yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah, no, I'm okay. But we have I have my YouTube channel that I've been posting a lot of things on it. I have my podcast, The Paul Mercurio Show. So I do one-on-one interviews there. And I've had people like Paul McCartney, Kevin Costner, Neil deGrasse Tyson. So there's something for everybody there. And that's an important thing that I do that I've been doing for a while. And we have a talk show that PBS wants to do with me. And so when we get out of this COVID thing and we can start to have produce shows again and an audience, have audiences, we're going to get back on track to get that up and running, but they want to syndicate it around the country, and which I'm really excited about. And then the other thing is my one man show that I was doing off Broadway. I'm going to be doing that again, which is called Permission to Speak. And we've been talking with a network about doing a show around that. So those are the two big things that, like everything else for everybody, is on hold, but those are the things I'm really psyched about. And then, you know, I'm always posting to social media and at Paul Mercurio and my YouTube channel every week, we're putting stuff up. So it's good creative outlets, you know?
This is great. And I will definitely, in the show notes on our website, I will put links to all of these various things. And I'm really excited for when we do get off of this weird lockdown timeframe to see both things, both your talk show as well as your off-Broadway show. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is great. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope it helps some people.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.